Today, stand by for deflation with Steve Van Meter. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of the latest posts covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today I have the Bond King with me, Steve Van Meter. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Martin. Good to see you again.
Yeah, great to have you back on the show. And we spoke, last year when the Fed was saying, well, inflation is transitory, nothing to see here, right? Boy, yeah. The world has changed. Or has it? This is the really interesting question, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the Fed finally had to just admit that even though inflation will be transitory, it's beyond their control of the timeline. And a lot of things that people don't understand is they think inflation is here to stay. And a lot of it still has to do with supply chain issues. I mean, we have an issue right now between the U.S. and Canadian border where trucks are backed up and not moving through. Ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. Last time I looked, there was somewhere around 100 cargo ships. So the Fed is right. Powell is right. Inflation will be transitory, but it just wasn't as transitory as they wanted. And now they're forced to do what they don't want to do, which is withdraw monetary policy.
Right. And a lot of this is actually, of course, driven by politics rather than economics, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, the Fed doesn't have any control over any of this stuff. I mean, they're literally just looking at the data and saying, well, it's running a little hotter, a little longer than we wanted. I mean, they're not the ones that can undo this, fix the supply chains. Monetary policy doesn't fix that.
Exactly. And interestingly, of course, as a result of all that, the old bond rate has gone through the roof. This is the 10-year currently, right, which is at 1.965. Just remind everybody that back in 2018, it was at 3.26, right? So it's all relative, isn't it, when it comes to, what the differences actually are?
Right. It is up, but it's not up that much, as you mentioned, historically. And it's kind of the old adage of, well, yields chase inflation, which is hilarious to me because interest rates, we see them live being traded. They are giving us a current indicator, whereas the consumer price index, if that's going to be the barometer that we're going to use, it has about a 6-month lag. So it's notable to me that a current indicator somehow is led by a lagging indicator in the minds of many investors, but that's not the case. There really isn't much of a relationship between yields and consumer prices. And all it takes is people to do a chart and they'll see that it doesn't make any sense. It's, I can't think of the last time I went and financed something, Martin, where they said, oh, well, here's a schedule before you pick the thing you want. If you spend this, if you finance this much, you pay this rate. If you finance more, you pay a higher rate and so on and so forth. That other than a jumbo loan for mortgages, that doesn't actually exist in the real world. But for some reason, people believe that higher consumer prices must be met with higher interest rates.
Well, as we've often said, the fact is that the fundamental connections that people assume are there between those various levers aren't actually there. In fact, they quite often work precisely the opposite way around.
Right. I mean, now, if we were seeing, and I'll use a word my friend Jeff Snyder, a phrase my friend Jeff Snyder hates, which is monetary inflation. But if we were seeing some form of money printing or lots of money sloshing around the economy, well, yeah, it would make sense. And interest rates should actually need to rise to soak that up. But in a case of supply chain inflation, the last thing you want is high interest rates because that's going to curtail demand. Now, in a weird way, that actually will help the Fed achieve its goal a little earlier. But this higher interest rates aren't going to solve this problem either. They're just going to lead to a significant drop off in demand.
Right. And that is the point, of course, because central banks basically have this one lever, right, marked interest rates up, interest rates down. Well, we'll pull it that way and hope something happens. Unfortunately, the linkages are actually not the ones that they think are there, right? It's a bit like, you move from an automatic car to a manual car and you sort of mess around with the gear stick, trying, well, hang on a moment, how does this all work? The fact is, it's not necessarily going to have the outcome that they expect.
Right. And it's only the Bank of England that's actually raising rates and tightening. I mean, the Fed is still actually easing. The European Central Bank is still easing. So you look at what's going around the world and it's like, we're not actually tightening. It's just the market is driving rates up in anticipation of this relationship. And all the market's going to do is curtail demand way ahead of the Fed and force, you know, the economy to recess. And this happens every time. And you can just go back in history. And I know you're a student of history and you look at these relationships, but everyone says, this time's different, Martin. Trust me. You know,
how different is it really this time? So what's your sense then in terms of, you know, the bond rates are higher. The German bond 10-year has just gone positive for the first time in nominal, not even if in real terms. The Bank of England is basically turning off its quantitative easing. They're pretty much the first ones to do it. Of course, the Fed hasn't done anything, right? They're still printing at the moment, aren't they?
Yeah, the Fed's still running at $60 billion a month, and on Valentine's Day, that should drop down to 30, if I've got my math correct, and then that ends somewhere early March, at least that's what they've been saying, I think before the FOMC meeting. So, they're still easing, and that's what's interesting about it. In the past, if we were doing $60 billion a month, everyone would be completely excited about that, but today, you see this drive up in yields. But what's important to understand for people watching the bond market is when you see the front end of the curve, so the twos, threes, five, when you see them rising up to the level where the 30s and 10s are at, and they start to converge or become very close to converging, you get an absolute reversal in direction. So you see an absolute collapse in yields following that. And because what it's telling you is that current financial conditions, if you look at like the front end of the curve, is telling you the growth and inflation expectations are the same as they are over the long term. And that should never be. I mean, you should always be in a position where your future growth is exceeding your current growth. So when you see that convergence, it's telling you that future growth and current growth are about the same level, and that's not good. And that's why ultimately you see a reversal. You don't always see a recession, although I think without fiscal stimulus this time, we will absolutely see a global recession.
Yeah, and it's true, I think, Steve, that many people, commentators, are on the inflationary side of the equation and thinking, you know, this is really hot, and you got to, you know, we're in the 1970s. But the truth is, the underlying trajectory here is actually deflationary, right? Because if the cost of borrowing goes up, we're already seeing it, actually. If you look at corporate borrowing costs, they've gone through the roof. People are going to actually put less on credit cards because their interest rates are going to be higher. The mortgage markets are coming off in some places. That will flow through potentially to house price growth easing back. Businesses will find it more expensive to borrow. And of course, quite a lot of cheap money that was taken when rates were really low will have to be refinanced higher later. So we're actually in this bit of a trap at the moment. I don't understand why people can't see it.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Martin, because new money is created when people borrow. So when rates go up, you get a curtailing in demand. Or like you mentioned, if you're borrowing at a very short-term rate, now your borrowing costs have gone up. So the new money being created in the economy slows down, and that's where your problems start to begin. We look back to the 1970s, and there's a big problem with the 70s and now, is that while there are a number of reasons we can explain inflation in the 70s, there's, from a monetary perspective, the U.S. should never actually experience high rates of inflation, because as a reserve currency, we should be exporting dollars. That is our primary export to the world, is we trade dollars for goods and services. So if you look back to the 70s, now I was born in the mid 70s, so we'll fast forward into the 80s where I was a kid, you know, foreign produced goods and services were garbage. I mean, you know, you'd see your neighbor buy a foreign car and you kind of almost laughed at him. They weren't in that same perception. You know, an Audi back in the early 80s was literally a piece of junk. Today, it's considered, you know, a very high-end luxury car. So in the system is, we didn't quite figure it out that the U.S. needs to export. But the problem is, you know, there wasn't anything to export and buy that was really good. But now there is, and you see that. And so when you look at all these ships sitting off the port of, say, California, off the ports of California, you look at all these trucks sitting at the border between U.S. and Canada, all that is dollars waiting to leave the country. As soon as those ships and trucks are unloaded, dollars leave, and we start exporting those, and we're back to exporting dollars and inflation. So that puts the burden on the financial system to create enough dollars to offset it. But if you have higher rates, as you just pointed out, well, then now you've got a problem. Dollars leaving, not enough new dollars created, and then, boom, you get a deflationary crash.
And add to that the energy costs, which, of course, oil prices are up towards 91, 92, or wherever it is, and people are now talking 100 US plus. That, of course, has another significant impact in terms of the cost of things.
Right, absolutely. So you think of, the typical consumer, at least when we look at wages in the U.S. and adjusted to inflation, is they're not keeping pace with inflation. So for a lot of families, in fact, I was just looking at an article earlier that says about half of all families in the U.S. that make $100,000 and less have been, find financial burden right now due to high prices. And you think about it, food prices are up, energy prices are up, and rent price and rents are rising. So if you have a limited budget and you're saying, okay, well, I have to spend more money on food, more money on gas, more money to heat my house, more money because the landlord just raised rent. Well, what does that leave less money for? Well, discretionary spending. Meanwhile, your ships after ships are just waiting to unload goods and services. And what do we start to see? Inventories rising. And it starts to make sense because people can't afford them without fiscal stimulus. And then as you pointed, well, now all of a sudden they got to start paying on their credit cards because, if you're used to getting money every month or quarter or whatever from the government, well, you can pay on those debts. Well, if that money goes away, well, now that's got to come out of your budget, and your budget just shrank. So yeah, we see a decline in consumption, and then ultimately that leads into an inventory recession as we have just too much inventory.
So if you think about all of that, then let's just sort of think about the markets, right? So now the stock markets have been very volatile. They've come off their highs, and there's a complete, I think headless chicken mode at the moment, where they're not quite sure whether to go up, to go down. Are tech stocks worth a lot? Are they not worth a lot? Some have dropped dramatically, some haven't. What's your sense on where the markets are going to head?
Well, there's no doubt that and everyone wants the markets to go back up, that this was, your generational buy the dip opportunity. And yet there almost seems to be that relationship that everyone kind of said, hey, quantitative easing makes stock prices go up. Well, it doesn't. It actually, there's no mechanical mechanism where QE buys stock prices, but it does create liquidity in the system, and people borrow money off their existing stock holdings and buy more stocks, and corporations borrow money and buy their stocks, and it causes stocks to go up. So now if we believe that QE makes stocks go up, then as QE gets withdrawn, well, then it starts to make sense where, all this recent dip that just billions and dollars were plowed into equities, it didn't move much. And in the past, this thing should be shooting to new all-time highs based on the amount of money came in. And it's all just a sign that liquidity is drying up and that amount of money going in doesn't matter.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why, I have the view that we are going to see some very, very volatile times ahead. There are some people who are still backing the other side that, no, the Fed won't do this. We'll actually see, more of the same. But I think we are now moving into a rather different environment. But how does that different environment then flow through to bonds in the slightly longer term in your mind, Steve?
Yeah, well, good question, because bonds tell you about future growth and inflation expectations. So if we have some clue that inflation is near a peak, and we'll find out here in a couple of days, at least on Thursday, the CPI prints, maybe it goes a little bit higher, but it's certainly getting pretty close to peaking, because you'll notice that crude oil, as you mentioned earlier, where it tends to peak is also kind of where inflation tends to start to flip and fall down. So what does it tell us? Well, if without fiscal stimulus, with a withdrawal of monetary stimulus, what are the prospects of future growth and inflation expectations? Well, they have to be lower, and that tells you, the interest rates need to come down. Again, back to what you kind of talked about earlier with people needing to borrow. Well, if rates are going up and people aren't borrowing as much and creating as new money, well, how does the monetary system get people to borrow and create new money? Well, rates have to go down, because the last time I checked, and maybe you could tell me if I'm wrong, Martin, but I have not noticed that people want to borrow at significantly higher interest rates. I think they do for a while, but there's a point where they say, I'm not going to refinance my house at a higher rate because it doesn't make any sense to make a higher payment. So generally what we see is higher rates lead to contraction in credit. Lower rates need to happen to spur credit growth, create money in the economy. And ultimately with growth and inflation expectations set to be lower, rates have to come down.
Right. And that means, of course, because if you think about where rates are even now, and they might go up a little, they'll have to come down back to close to zero or maybe even negative rates, right?
Right.
Because that's basically the only the only lever they've got. And I want to draw a connection here between the discussion about central bank digital currencies and negative rates, right? Because actually, if you don't have the central bank digital currency there, it's much harder to make negative rates work.
Well, yeah, I mean, let's start with the first part is there's a reason why every cycle ends in rates going to a new all-time low, because, you know, why would I refinance something at the same rate or higher rate? Well, no, maybe I'll refinance my house at an even lower rate, and that gives me a little more take-home pay, and that little more take-home pay means more money going out in the economy. So there's definitely, in my view, we'll see lower rates. Now, as far as going to negative rates, I actually believe we will see a fair part of the U.S. Treasury curve go negative. And I don't know that that has anything specifically to do with central bank digital currencies, as much as I believe it will have everything to do with wanting to hold collateral. Because in the U.S. financial system, financial institutions are required to hold collateral, but what's interesting about it is they can borrow the collateral. And so people always notice that, you know, in the great financial crisis, why did yields just go just literally straight down? Well, there's a point where I actually need to substantiate and prove that I've got that collateral because things are really bad. And if I've been borrowing that collateral, well, then I have to go buy that collateral. And if everyone goes and buys the collateral, you see an outright collapse. And the question will be will there be such a demand for collateral that it takes rates negative? And this is where we look to Japan, where you see in their system, you don't see a lot of people, like companies aren't buying their stock back and doing a lot of things. People are actually holding on to collateral because the system is so weak. So the question will be is not that rates will collapse and potentially go negative. The question is how negative will they go due to the demand for everyone actually needing to hold on to collateral instead of actually borrowing it.
Yeah, and I remind everybody again, that one lever that the Fed and other central banks have is up, down on interest rates, right? So they can pull them negative. And interestingly, in Australia, banks here have been given a time frame to plan for negative rates, right? And it's interesting that that's hardly been reported recently in the mainstream media, because they're all talking about rates going up, right? And it's like, hey, look over there. You know, that's a really important thing. They are preparing here in Australia that banks need to be able to cope with negative rates. That tells you something quite important, I think.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting is sometimes I get asked is, why would anyone buy negative yielding government debt? Well, that's simple, because your bank charges you more to hold your cash there, because at this point, there's really no investment opportunity. So everyone wants to hold cash. And the banks have, you know, they can't do anything with it. They have too much cash now. So why would I choose to go and buy a negative yielding government debt? Well, what if my bank came out and said, hey, Steve, we're going to charge you $500 a month based on your account balance? Well, gee, a negative government debt, a bond or a note at that point would be much more attractive, because I know that I'm going to lose less money, but I'm going to still park my money. And I think that people don't realize that is actually going to happen, is the banks are going to be so swamped with cash. The only answer is we're going to charge you so much money to make you leave, and there's nowhere to go. So you'll go buy negative yielding government debt.
Absolutely. Yes. And of course, in some areas of Europe, they have been starting to charge some depositors, yep, particularly large depositors, just to hold the money at the bank, right? And you sort of scratch your head thinking, on a moment, that's not the way that it should work.
But that's it. That's it right there. So if you were in Europe and you had these massive deposits, you literally just explain the whole thing is, and I've been a bit charged by the bank. Well, it's much cheaper to go buy negative yielding debt. And I can now mathematically calculate my loss, and I'm okay with it because it's better than what the bank would charge me, and everybody wins.
Absolutely. Now, last couple of questions, gold, right? So there have been a lot of people saying gold is where you should be because in an inflationary world, you know, but actually it's not really quite like that, is it?
No, because again, gold is not a hedge against supply chain inflation. I mean, it all comes down to what type of inflation we are experiencing. Everyone just lumps it as, oh, look, prices are up. And sometimes you have to just peel back one layer on the onion to be like, well, what type is it? Is there a lot of money sloshing around the system? No. What are we experiencing? Supply chain inflation. So gold doesn't fix that. Neither does crypto, neither monetary policy. A lot of things do not fix that. People going back to work and getting the regulations out of the way and getting supplies moved, that'll fix it.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, it goes back to real economic activity rather than just the financial system, right? And I have to say, I don't know what it's like over in the US at the moment, but we've got still massive issues here with businesses not investing, particularly small businesses. The environment is not appropriate to do that. So the overall momentum in terms of the real economy in creating real value and real things is still very, very low. And that's another lens that I bring to bear to say, yeah, things are not as flash as your politicians and your central bankers would want you to try and convince yourself that they are.
Right. And they're because politicians and central banks are hoping. And so I guess a little difference in Australia is because we had the fiscal stimulus running so much longer than I think anywhere else, that small businesses remain optimistic. For some reason, they buy into the surveys show that they're kind of buying into the view that there's going to be all this demand. Meanwhile, their shelves are starting to build up with inventory, and they're starting to actually lay off despite, alleged 11 million job openings here in the U.S. We're seeing layoffs start to tick up. And I don't know what point these small business owners, flipped their view, but I assume it will come fairly soon.
Well, it's interesting because our latest surveys on business, particularly small business, continues to be negative. And people were putting it down to, the virus and everything else. But it's a much more structural issue, in my view. Some of them are beginning to wake up to the fact that actually it doesn't make sense, So we'll see. So let's come back to the bond kingdom then. So basically, despite all of the noise out there, you're still pretty positive about the bond kingdom.
Yeah, absolutely. People ask me all the time, have you changed your view? Has your thesis changed? I said, no, because we haven't. The end game hasn't played out. It was always a long-term view. I will say, and I'm no problem publicly stating that, yeah, I probably should have changed out of the thesis at March, but I didn't have any historical reference for what you do during a pandemic, and I had no expectation that people would take their fiscal stimulus and spend it when historically they've actually saved it or paid off debt. But, we could say that I missed the bus. And I always like to caution investors because, that happens all the time. People say, well, I should have bought here, should have sold there. And it's like, hey, look, don't go place chase because that's the worst thing you can do. Cycles always repeat. So if you're deep in a position and you're okay with it, just wait for the next bus. It's okay. It's okay to be wrong for a while unless you are in something that you're really wrong about. And in this case, well, we know exactly how the monetary system is going to function here and what's the likely outcome. And when you have a recession, future growth and inflation expectations tank, and yields are going to tank, and every cycle so far led to lower yields. So in the end, it eventually plays out, and I'm very much okay with that.
And the point there is, of course, that the amount of stimulus that the Fed and the governments around the world, central banks around the world did was remarkably high. And so no surprise then that it sort of, affected the timing of things. But if your mental model of the way the economic and macro system works is, the way you've described it, it will ultimately work out. It's just a matter of timing. Timing is always the difficult part. And sometimes people have said to me, you were bearish on house prices. Well, yeah, I was, because I didn't really think that in Australia we would see huge amounts of money from the government, really ultra low interest rates and very cheap money going to the banks to basically force them to lend and to offer really cheap mortgages, right? No, none of the models that I'd actually developed had that scenario in it because it'd never been done before, right? So that's right. The reason. But that doesn't mean that the fundamental mental model that I've got underlying my modeling is incorrect. It just means that there was an additional factor that you've got to actually take account of now. But that doesn't change the strategic view, right? And both you and I believe deflation and lower rates is ultimately the destination because, well, it's happened before. And nothing has changed. And in fact, you could argue that the withdrawal of so much stimulus is going to have a more significant and probably a more negative impact more quickly than many people expect.
Yeah, I was just going to make that point. I think you're spot on, Martin, is people see the withdrawal of stimulus, fiscal and monetary stimulus as bullish. It's like, wow, you should see just the opposite because the economy has been living on that. And we're making a pretty rapid withdrawal. And without it, I hope everything works out okay. Base case, we get probably a face plant.
Absolutely. Steve, I really enjoy speaking with you. We do seem to see things rather similarly, which is a bit scary, but yeah. Coming from rather different perspectives. But the fact is that this narrative is a really important narrative at this stage, because so many people are on the other side of the fence, right? So many people are banking on, all of those things that the central banks say. And I just want to come back to where I came into this. Remember, central banks are ultimately about politics, not economics.
Right. Yeah. And then you have to think, some people have chased this rally, taken a lot of leverage, made money. In the past, when I've gone to Vegas and, gambled, I've learned when you're up, you take some chips and put them in your pocket, because that means you have to reach it. If you leave them on the table, you're more likely to keep playing with them. But if you put them in your pocket and some of your gains, at least if you get wiped out on your chips on the table, you can get up and walk away and still play another day. And unfortunately, as you and I know, that almost never happens. Recessions just wipe people out because they were just over leveraged. And I think all we're telling people is, look, right or wrong, if you're up, take some money off the table.
Absolutely. Cash is quite useful at the moment, I think, in terms of the current position. And, again, a lot of people have been saying cash is trash. Well, hang on a moment. Just think about, if you've got that there sitting there, and then there's an opportunity down the track, and if you look back at the great recessions of the past, the people who actually were on the right side were able to come in at the right point in the cycle and benefit from it, right? But if you're locked in, you've got no hope.
Right. And if you really think cash is trash, you can send your checks to the Martin and Steve Cash Fund. We will take all the trash that you don't want.
Absolutely, Steve. Yeah, so all donations great to receive. Really appreciate your time. Great to talk to you. Talk again soon. Cheers, Steve.
Always a pleasure, my friend.